I'm Brian Atkinson. I work for Red Hat and on the IT identity management team. I am not related to Red Hat sales or marketing, so I'm not trying to sell you anything here. I just want to walk you through how we do identity management at Red Hat and how we use our various open source tools and utilities, as well as a lot of community projects. So how many people here use Active Directory? How many of you like Active Directory? All right, one. That's fair enough. We have a small AD instance, too, I'll admit, too. We've bought some Windows companies such as JBoss in the past and Accenture, or not Accenture, I'm sorry. So we do have some Windows laptops that we have to support, and so we do have an AD instance that we try to minimize and segment off and try not to touch, and I'll kind of show you how we do that. So I'm assuming since you're here, you've read the description. I'll move along. About Red Hat, we'll kind of talk about how Red Hat IT and my team is structured. I don't know if it's similar to your organizations, but that's how we do it. Do a kind of an overview of our identity management solutions, talk a little bit about our users, and then get into LDAP, Kerberos, two-factor auth, SAML, PKI. And I'll talk a little bit about IDM and free IPA. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but they're emerging technologies. So at Red Hat, I'm assuming pretty much everyone here knows what Red Hat is and what we do. In addition to the Rail operating system, we also have products in the cloud space, virtualization, storage, and middleware. In Red Hat IT, so Red Hat IT supports pretty much everything in production at Red Hat. This includes the redhat.com website, RHN, access.redhat.com. If you're a customer, you're probably familiar with these tools. We also support email collaboration tools, chat, identity management, of course, that's my team. We also do data management as well as data center services for the rest of the company. We have some very large virtualization environments that we use for production and pre-production services. And we provide hosted environments back to the various business units. We're responsible for a lot of the SaaS applications that are in use today. We do have a Google Drive instance and things of that nature. And finally, like most organizations, we provide our help desk style support. So, as I mentioned, I'm on the Identity and Access Management team. About a year ago, it was identity management solutions within Red Hat IT were separated out across the IT organization, which is about a 200-person organization. I was on a sysadmin team and responsible for LDAP, Kerberos, in addition to my day job of providing virtualization and various other support. Our federated authentication system was provided by another development group. So doing what Red Hat IT likes to do, we reorged. We formed a very small identity and access management team consisting of 5 people. We have application engineers and systems engineers, really 2 of each. And our mission is to build, deploy, and really manage these identity management solutions going forward. Our production operations teams provide operational support for these, but we're obviously engaged in the process in a very DevOps-y model. As was mentioned, I've been at Red Hat 8 years now. I've done a lot of work in architecting the virtualization and identity management solutions we have today. It's the 6th time I've been at LISA, the first time I'm presenting, so be gentle. And I've worked for a variety of nonprofits and the University of California system, as well as did some radio astronomy work with NASA JPL, which was pretty interesting. We got to do the initial radar imaging of Mars for Spirit and Opportunity, so that was kind of cool. So I'll just kind of go over a brief overview of how IT server environment is structured. It's obviously a much larger topic. On the data center physical infrastructure side of things, We obviously use Red Hat Storage to provide NFS storage, a cluster. We're a fairly large NetApp shop for providing NFS and block storage. On the server side, we use Cisco UCS Blade servers. We found those to be very nice. And on the rack mount server side, we use IBM X Series and UCS rack mount. We also have tons of other equipment manufacturers throughout the environment. And are on the engineering development side, they obviously have everything that's ever been created. So for our rack mount, we're a pretty heavy virtualization shop, but we do have some large database, standalone database servers that we have to support. So that's where we use the rack mount systems. On the network side, we use Cisco and Juniper. We have pretty strong partnerships with both Cisco and Juniper. And as well as using UCS on the server side, it helps to have Nexus hardware upstream. And of course, we have various appliances throughout the environment, IPS system, F5 load balancers, and so on. We do use LVS on the open source side of things some, but for our main production workloads, we do use F5 load balancers. On the data center software side, as you can imagine, we run RHEL. We're currently today supporting RHEL 4, 5, 6, and 7. We've successfully moved away from all of our RHEL 2.1 and RHEL 3 OSs. Anyone still running 3 or 2.1? Yeah. All right. Red Hat Linux 7. So we're fully virtualized almost, except for the large database instances I mentioned. Pretty much everything sits on top of Rev, and now we're bringing OpenStack into the environment. But to date, pretty much Origin, Access.redhat.com, these are all hosted on top of Rev. We have about 200 hypervisors and 10 Rev managers. We did a write-up with our support organization last year on the environment details of how we use Rev, RHEL, and UCS under the hood, as well as NetApp and Red Hat Storage to provide our virtualization stack. So if you want, you can read about that. It goes into pretty substantial detail. So on the cloud side, pretty much everyone these days is moving software into the cloud. We are no different. We're making use of OpenShift Enterprise internally, which is the enterprise product for OpenShift. This allows us to provide our users and various development users past the application environment so they could just spin up their own applications as needed. It's actually seen a fair amount of use, more than I thought it would. We do use AWS, and actually we just moved redhat.com, www.redhat.com to AWS, and that's completely hosted there using Drupal. It's tended to work very well as our first major application to move into the cloud, essentially. We have an OpenStack self-service environment where people could go and get whatever OpenStack VMs they want. As well as on the IT development side, we do something similar with using Foreman, which is what Red Hat Satellite 6 is based on, to front-end Rev instances. This allows for our developers to have a VM that looks very much like production, in fact, identical to the production deployment. It's all self-service, and they can spin up how many ever they want to really have that environment on demand. So Red Hat IT has always been a huge believer in configuration management. Anyone here use Puppet? Yeah, seems like most people these days use Puppet. When I joined Red Hat in 2007, we were using CF Engine 2 and had this horrible Perl templating engine built on top of CF Engine. It was a nightmare. It took people about a year to learn and to be useful with it. So in 2008, we committed whole hog to Puppet and have since then have been rapidly developing modules and have standardized our entire global infrastructure on Puppet. We've worked a lot with Puppet Labs, Reductive Labs at the time, on our environment, as well as bringing them in. We work together on the F5 Puppet module that's on Puppet Forge, if you've ever used that. So that was originally, we worked together to develop that. So the way we run Puppet, it's a little bit different than, I guess, Puppet Lab would tell you how to run Puppet today. And this is mainly because we've been running Puppet since 2008, and we've kind of built up our own internal knowledge and code base around Puppet, around a complete utility set around Puppet and pushing code into production. So the way we do this, each Puppet module is its own Git repo. An application may have one or more, usually more, Puppet modules associated with it, usually like a library module and then something to consume that module. The Puppet modules themselves are branched Git modules with a branch aligning to the various dev environments, and the dev environments can be on demand, QA, stage, and finally production. We typically add new functionality in a feature branch, then merge it into the appropriate dev environment and push it up through the stack. We do have a variety of custom post-commit hooks and pre-commit hooks for managing the code in this environment. And that includes, essentially, when I push my commit, it then does a post-commit hook to push it out to the various other Puppet masters using Git. And so this is how we distribute my change to our 43 Puppet masters, which some manage dev environments, some QA, some prod, and so forth. R10K, if you're familiar with that, does very similar to what we do. We would have used R10K if it was around when we implemented this, but it just wasn't. On the commit hook side, we do full Puppet syntax checking, linting, before the commit's actually accepted. So if I'm going to do a git push, it better be syntactically correct and conform to our coding styles. We also have hooks to enforce the branch parenting, which, and I'm not really familiar with R10K if it does this or not, but if you use git branching, parenting can be somewhat of an issue. So we have a variety of scripts that enforce the dev branches are a child of QA, and which are a child of stage, then child of prod. And this really enforces any code that goes into prod to be tested in every other environment first. And when we rolled out Puppet, we switched from CVS to Git at that time and have since come to love Git. So, kind of getting into what this talk is about, this is our identity management environment in a nutshell. Essentially, everything's backed by Kerberos and LDAP. We tie in our one-time password solutions to our SAML Federation, Federated Authentication System, and then clients, lab systems, users, other systems, cloud systems will then consume these in one form or another. Most apps internally use GSS API authentication for authentication and LDAP for user information. So I'll talk a little bit about our users. Red Hat is an engineering company. We are very much an engineering company. About 50% of our users are highly technical. And these are engineers in one department or another throughout the company. Everyone, and I do mean everyone, believes they're a sysadmin and that they know better. We have a couple company-wide mailing lists where we get told that on a daily basis. So we try in this environment and really try to work together with both Red Hat Engineering and the other groups to run things in both the best practice standards as well as what we feel works the best for our environment. In addition to this, we have our typical sales and marketing people, administrative, legal, HR. You know, these I would classify as non-technical users. So that's kind of what we're dealing with on a daily basis. So for Red Hat, IT believes strongly in choice. And this means that users can choose whatever OS they want. They could choose a Mac if they want. We issue a standard Lenovo laptop with our RHEL corporate standard build on it. And this is just a RHEL 7 image that's been with some various applications added onto it. The more technical folks will usually install RHEL or Fedora or Rawhide or whatever other distribution of the day that they want to. And so we try to make whatever services we provide work in all these and we using standard protocols. We do have a Windows population that I mentioned. There's about 200 laptops that our HR legal people will use as they need. There's just, you know, the reality of today is that to do business in globally, you really have to use Windows at some point or another. We've worked hard to change that, but that's still the case. So we don't want to be an impediment to us, you know, closing our quarterly numbers or, you know, working with legal. So we choose to offer whatever makes users most productive. Obviously, the problem with choice is some people choose wrong, so what can you do? Some users choose Mac OS. You know, no offense to the skinny jeans crowd here. And on the mobile side, we see Android and iOS devices, as well as everything else. People will come to us with pretty much any device and expect to be able to get mail on it. So, from an internal application access standpoint, this is usually how most of our applications will work. At this point, most applications are web-based. A user will hit a web-based application, which on the back end will either accept GSS API tickets or do radius authentication to our OTP server. And on the back end, that application will be consuming LDAP data. From an externally hosted SaaS application perspective, these are applications that are for Red Hat associates that are hosted outside of our firewalls and users, things like Salesforce, right, where users will need to be able to access them externally. So for those applications, they'll consume SAML authentication. And on the back end, SAML will talk to either LinOTP or Kerberos, depending on the situation, which I'll get into shortly, and well as consuming LDAP data. So for LDAP, anybody using anything other than Active Directory? Yeah, what are you guys using? Open LDAP? Red Hat Directory Server? Good man. 389? 636? All right. As you can imagine, we use Red Hat Directory Server. We work closely with Red Hat Directory Server developers. And we usually hit bugs hopefully before you do. And we originally migrated from NIS to Directory Server in 2006 following our Netscape acquisition. Before that, the entire company was based on NIS. Today in production, we're using RHDS 9.1, latest on RHEL 6.6. Once Directory Server is available on RHEL 7, we'll immediately switch to that. We have around 36 nodes in production globally. It varies depending on who's doing what. Our LDAP tree is around 130,000 objects. For a company of roughly 8,000 people, there's a lot more than just user and group accounts there. We found this Directory Server to be a hardened, stable, multi-master directory server. Frankly, if it wasn't, Red Hat IT is free to choose whatever applications we want. obviously we were kind of biased towards Red Hat products, but if a Red Hat product isn't working out for us, we're free to switch to something else and do occasionally. Giving that feedback to engineering so they could go fix whatever's wrong. So 389DS remains the upstream open source project. So that's weird. Apologies. OpenOffice isn't keeping up here. All right, so for LDAP, we don't just use it as an internet directory. We use we store user accounts, group accounts, both POSIX accounts and a group of names, which are kind of your historical LDAP style groups, similar to what Active Directory uses. But in addition to this, we store application data. One thing that we do that is kind of novel is all of our mail routing information is stored in LDAP as LDAP objects. We also have our account lifecycle management system that uses LDAP as a backend. We store application role data in LDAP. And finally, we're using LDAP as a public key storage system for both GPG and SSH public keys. So I mentioned that we're a huge puppet shop. Our directory server is no different. We've written a couple different directory server puppet modules that take care of the complete installation configuration, going from an unprovisioned node to a fully active slave or master in about 2 minutes. The module takes care of replication agreement creation, setting up multi-master or slave agreements. If you've ever used 389DS or RHDS, you know that configuring SSL can be kind of a burden. So we just automated all that, and you know, we just point it to the X509 search and it's done. Working as soon as I get some time to upload this directory server module to Puppet Forge. The ones that are there, they kind of work, but ours is more feature complete. So we use directory server in order to be able to store a lot of this information, particularly on the application side. We have to modify the schema. And to do this, in addition to the INET org person stuff, we have our own user and group schema extensions that we've added. Also added a schema to support automation. I mentioned that we use LDAP for mail routing. This is using SendMail. And so we've extended the schema to support really adding the SendMail aliases and access files in LDAP. And finally, we've extended things to support GPG keys, so you could use our LDAP servers as a GPG key server, which is kind of cool. There'll be a link later on where you could download the SendMail and GPG schema if you're interested. It's based on a lot on the open LDAP work, but obviously for directory server, it had to be changed. Apologies for this slide being somewhat busy. This is really at the heart of how we structure our environment for LDAP. We have two or more, these days we have four LDAP masters that are all multi-master. Everyone can accept writes and reads and replicate their changes out to the other masters as well as slaves. In our various regional colos and data centers, we'll usually have two LDAP slaves dedicated to LDAP lookups for systems based in that colo, as well as two systems behind a load balancer for users to consume. If you're in Europe, you obviously want to consume LDAP server data in Europe. In one of our main production facilities, we'll have a variety of load balanced clusters, consisting of, you know, 6 to 10 LDAP slaves to handle the workload One is dedicated to just sendmail. We found that for every sendmail email, every hop that a message makes, it will hit LDAP 3 times. We process a ridiculous amount of email on a daily basis. Red Hat is a company based on IRC and email. So we handle an enormous amount of mail. So we've obviously had to scale our LDAP environment to be able to support this level of queries. Then we have a general cluster that applications, that's load balanced applications, can consume the data however they see fit. It's fairly trivial to add new nodes as we need to. Finally, we have a replication in sync with Active Directory. And the way what we do here is we replicate our users and groups to Active Directory. This way, we manage them in Directory Server. Complete user lifecycle management. They get created and termed in LDAP. That data just flows to Active Directory. We don't want to touch it. We don't want anything to do with Active Directory, so we just, here's the data, go away. Then finally, we do have a cluster that's quasi-internet facing for the various SaaS applications. That's a fractional replica. It contains a very small subset of the information, just the information that's needed for those applications to function. So on the LDAP tree side of things, we maintain a flat OU equals users tree, subtree. Red Hat and Red Hat IT in particular, we love to reorg. Like at least every year, usually more than once a year, Red Hat IT management will reorg us. Usually it's in response to fixing the problems associated with the last reorg. So rather than trying to keep up with this organizational structure in an LDAP like you would do in an Active Directory environment, everybody goes in OU equals users, and we flag users with attributes and what groups they belong in, what departments, what cost centers, and so on. We store our POSIX groups in OU equals users, so if you're doing an LS on any random server we have, that information will be fed from, the group information will be fed from LDAP, from the OU equals users tree. We do have to support group of name and group of unique name style groups for various applications. It's pretty common in the LDAP world to need these type of groups, so we support them, we just have a separate OU to hold all this application data. And then depending on the applications, they may have their own OU designated to them that they could then further divide and manage as they see fit. So for the user data sources, what our goal is to limit the amount of integrations people have to do. Application groups spinning up new applications, we want them to use LDAP. We don't want them to tie into our HRM solution. We don't want them to have to go and build some integrations into the facilities management system. Everything flows into LDAP, and then LDAP's what people consume. This eliminates us from having to do a lot of database-style integrations. Basically, we just do one, and that's to create the information flow into LDAP. We pull some information out of various systems, and those systems are authoritative for that specific data. LDAP's considered authoritative for user data, UID, GID, and so forth. We have a facilities management system that tracks where people are located, what cubes, what offices, if they're remote, if they're not. And so we integrate to the system and pull it into LDAP. Making this information usable for everyone, and we really make use of LDAP for what it's there for, is, you know, the frequent reads, occasional writes. It's not a database, right? We just want people to read from it and read from it frequently. Some attributes are self-service, and so users are free to change their IRC nickname as they see fit, the phone number, so forth. And we do allow users to upload their GPG and SSH public signing keys. SSH public keys are associated with their user object. We have a separate OU for GPG data. If you've ever done a GPG LDAP integration, it's kind of funky the way GNU GPG requires the data to be structured. So from a mail routing side, we have a OU dedicated to mail routing. And this is a very large tree. We have 80,000 aliases. And that, I mentioned, we are a company of 8,000 people. So do the math. So we have to support a ridiculous amount of aliases. We use this OU for mail routing. And when we implemented this, we needed a replacement to send mail, alias, and access files. We used to keep those files in configuration management, and you know it was a mess, and only sysadmins could update people's aliases, and we did nothing else. So we threw all that information into LDAP, have a couple of GUI front ends where people and as well as our help desk can manage the data as they see fit, as well as various automation. So Red Hat Directory Server, 389 Directory Server, has a really nice plugin architecture. This allows you to extend Directory Server as you see fit. We use a variety of plugins to solve very unique use cases for us. I mentioned that we killed NIS and switched to Directory Server. Well, the problem is a lot of our users still want to use NIS. We're not happy with it, but that's the case. So we have a Directory Server plugin that publishes our user and group data via NIS. We also have a PAM pass-through authentication plugin, and I'll get more into that in a second. But this essentially allows us to use any back-end PAM authentication store for user authentication. We don't store user passwords in LDAP at all. And finally, we do use the member of plugin, and this plugin essentially will update your user object with whatever groups you belong to. A lot of applications will expect that member of syntax. So the PAM pass-through authentication module, this originally came about when we were implementing a Directory Server. We did not want to store passwords in Directory Server. We wanted to store passwords in Kerberos because that's where they belong, and that's what our users expect. Our users really like Kerberos. So we worked with engineering, Directory Server engineering, and came up with this plugin that allows basically any backend authentication source to be used for LDAP. So if I'm a user, I bind with my LDAP DN, I can now use either my Kerberos password or other passwords that I might have. This has become in really handy, and that any other PAM authentication source will work, not just Kerberos. And I'll speak about that in a second. So that kind of sums up our LDAP environment. It's a critical piece of our environment, and it's used a ridiculously amount. And it's only very recently that the business has really come to appreciate what an integrated and critical piece of infrastructure it is. So talk a little bit about Kerberos. We don't do a whole lot of special with Kerberos. I love this picture. So we have a standard Kerberos realm. It's pretty much as old as the company itself. It started on Red Hat Linux, I don't know, 4.2 or something, right? And it's been upgraded ever since, and databases reinitialized. But at its heart, it's essentially the same data, obviously gone through various password changes and encryption algorithm changes. So most of the interesting things we do with Kerberos is on the application side, but we do maintain this Kerberos realm. It's obviously puppetized, so it's fairly trivial to install new Kerberos slaves as well as a new master. It's a single master, which kind of sucks. It is possible to promote a slave to a master, but it's a manual process. And this is one of the key, our key items for next fiscal year is to fix the single point of failure. So, as I mentioned, Kerberos is highly adopted throughout the organizations. Users get really, really cranky if they have to type in their password more than once. And I do mean cranky, and we'll bitch about it on the company-wide mailing list over and over. So basically, users authenticate once in the morning. They could then access any protected resource all day long, as much as they want. So it's very integrated. Even on the non-technical side, our standard build laptop that we hand out, non-technical users uses SSSD on the back end, and this allows essentially offline authentication, where a user can authenticate to their laptop using their Kerberos password without it necessarily being connected to the VPN or the corporate network. And then once the laptop comes online, it'll refresh the credentials and get a TGT on behalf of the user. Let me see, and this is really the start of our unified SSO authentication strategy, where we want users to have one set of credentials that they use everywhere. And so with that, I mentioned we want users to have one set of credentials. Well, they kind of have two. We use a two-factor authentication system using one-time passwords. Anyone using RSA at this point? Wow, brave. So we at one time we had RSA implemented, and then very bad things happened, right? So we at that point we switched. We adopted the LinOTP project, and we've since formed a partnership with them. We have enterprise support from LinOTP, and this is an open source one-time password system. It has a primary-secondary architecture, and this allows pretty much standard-based tokens, so users can use whatever soft or hard tokens they want to. Red Hat has written a free OTP application that's available on iPhone and Android that I use simply because I like it better than Google Authenticator. It allows you to have multiple authentication sources and one-time passwords on the same screen. So it's kind of nice. On the hard token side, we have Gemalto tokens and YubiKey. And I'll leave the argument over whether soft tokens are really tokens for the hallway track. But our users do use both hard and soft tokens. So where do we use two-factor auth? And it's really when users are transiting the untrusted to trusted border. And this means if you're coming from an environment where you haven't authenticated via a token of one sort or another, you'll be prompted to enter your credentials, your one-time password and your token. We also use it for kind of the SOX in-scope systems, such as the HRM solution and other SOX systems, really just to because we were lazy and didn't want to meet their password change requirements of once per quarter or something. So guess what? You get OTP. So if users accessing those, they need to use their OTP credentials. And so on the application support side, this is how we provide OTP auth for applications without using a lot of proprietary software. And OTP, like a lot of two-factor authentication systems, can use Radius on the back end. And unfortunately, a lot of applications can't speak Radius. But guess what? They speak LDAP. So enter the PAM pass-through plugin for LDAP. This allows us to front-end OTP solutions with LDAP. So the application is talking LDAP, but it requires the user's OTP token. This has worked out really well. Radius support is adopted in the networking world pretty well, but various applications don't really speak Radius very much. And no, this isn't a picture of our backup solution. It's, So with that, talk a little bit about our SAML infrastructure. Who's running SAML? Yeah, what do you guys use? Shibboleth? 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 Anyone using Oracle Identity Federation? OpenSSO? All right. I joke because Oracle killed OpenSSO. So there's a ton of them, a ton of federated log authentication systems out there. Most of them have cloud or open in their names, right? Most of them suck. So the path we went down is to kind of build our own. If you're not familiar with SAML, it's a standard that's been around forever. Basically, it provides a way of authenticating users, and it's really come into popularity in cloud-based environments. The SAML standard's extremely long and complicated if you've ever tried to read it. It's the core of it's 86 pages long, and that's only half of it. And there's an optional spec that just causes nothing but confusion. So very recently, SAML seems to have gained a lot of traction as businesses have moved things to the cloud and to SaaS-based and hosted applications. The need for SAML authentication has arisen in a way that it simply didn't before. SAML has been around since 2002. SAML 2.0 was 2005, but it really seems like the last couple years it's seen a lot of growth. And the reason, in my opinion, that it's seen this growth is that it's a very elegant design in that it detaches the authentication source from the service provider. This means that all communications between your authentication source and the service consuming it happens through your browser. Don't need direct network connection. They don't have to be on the same networks at all or even aware of each other, except through a back-end metadata exchange. This is really, really handy. Of course, this changes somewhat if you're doing federated logout, but I'll get to why that's a pain in a little bit. But the critical takeaway is that there's no direct communication. On identity provider is what is actually the authentication source. So it would be whatever talks to Kerberos or LDAP or whatever, right? Versus your service provider, which would be Google Drive or Mail, something that is actually consuming, that needs the user to be authenticated, but doesn't want to authenticate the user directly. And so what we went down the path of using is JBoss Picket Link. Picket Link is a sub-project of JBoss. It's available in EAP and Wildfly. And Picket Link provides the identity management framework within JBoss that supports SAML 2.0, as well as a ton of other standards. So we went down the path of really downloading one of the Picket Link quick starts, talking with the developers. Then we modified the quick start to meet our needs. At that point, we had our own very own SAML application that we maintain internally on my team. And we've done this for the last about 2 years now, and we formed really great relationships with both the Picket Link developers as well as JBoss developers. Our general architecture is that users will access a load balanced IP that's backed by a JBoss cluster consisting of two or four or more nodes, depending on what it is. The EAP cluster will share the user sessions amongst all the nodes. On the back end, this application maps the user's credentials and will reach out to LDAP, Kerberos, and LinOTP as necessary to authenticate the user and as well as provide authorization to the service provider using it. We do provide role data as part of our SAML assertion so that a service provider will be able to consume that this user is part of this role that has access, eliminating the fact that not all of our users might need to access this application. So on the configuration management side of things, mentioned, we use Puppet, right? So our IDP code is completely Puppetized. And this, one of the problems we ran into is that if you've ever tried to do a metadata exchange between an identity provider and service provider, it's a nightmare, it takes forever, you know, it's all XML-based, no one wants to do it. So we try to abstract a lot of that complexity by using configuration management. So templated all the XML files to add a new service provider. It's as simple as actually adding a one-line addition to our YAML file. Of course, if the application needs something more, then we have to do something a little bit different. But for the most part, it's one line plus maybe, I don't know, a couple lines of metadata. So our clustered architecture allows us to deploy and really restart JBoss on these nodes as we see fit, and without causing any interruption for the end user. And so when we deploy a new service provider, it's just done in a rolling fashion. We push it, the servers bounce one at a time, and all is happy. We do deploy an exploited WAR file. Rather than having JBoss deploy the WAR file, we deploy it ourselves, and this way we use Puppet to manage a lot of the files within that WAR file and have been able to construct this templating system on top of it. My group of five people, we typically do at least one or more releases a week on either adding new service provider integrations or, you know, code upgrades or whatever. And there's a ton of service provider libraries and modules out there. So we've also taken it upon our team to try to make these various SP libraries and modules as easy to consume for other groups as possible. And so if a group wants to add SAML authentication to their application, really all they have to do is import our Puppet class. One thing that I mentioned is we work really closely with the PicketLink developers. And we, in this journey that we've had over the last couple of years, we found that our users really need something above and beyond what PicketLink and JBoss can provide. So we've worked with them and provided this additional functionality to both JBoss and PicketLink. One thing is GSS API support. Another one is actually being able to replicate one-time password sessions between cluster nodes. And we've done some stuff with assertion granularity. If you've dealt with SAML, you know that the SP and IDP might not necessarily like things signed in the same way. And finally, we're working on a way to bring sanity to logout. So, one of the frequent complaints we received was that users who were on a trusted source were still having to use their one-time password credentials to authenticate to SAML. And this resulted in some very cranky people. So what we did was we spent a lot of work working in order to provide Kerberos GSS API support to PicketLink. So now users can, if they have a Kerberos TGT ticket, they can now authenticate to the IDP using that, and they get immediate authentication. Don't have to pull out their token and try to authenticate against. Again, this really provides for the single sign-on panacea that we've all been promised. This works very well. The problem is our security policy says that if you're transiting the untrusted to trusted border, you need to use one-time passwords. So essentially, how this works is if a user is coming from a trusted source, they could use their Kerberos credentials and all is good. If they're coming from the internet at large or someplace else, they need to authenticate using their one-time passwords. Full support for GSS API authentication within JBoss PicketLink will be available in EAP 632, which is, if it hasn't dropped, it will drop sometime in the near future. 630 and 631, it was mostly working, but there were some final code changes we needed to make. Anybody know of a SAML solution that allows GSS API authentication? I wasn't aware of one either. So I mentioned that we replicate sessions. So if a user is coming from an untrusted source and they need to authenticate with their one-time passwords, we don't want them to have to re-authenticate if we do a rolling maintenance release where we have to restart the cluster or restart nodes in the cluster. Before we went down this path, the way JBoss session replication worked with the login module was that it essentially tried to replay the user's password on the other node when it would be necessary. So if I shut down one node, it would then JBoss would immediately try to replay the user's password they typed in an hour ago into the other node and to authenticate them. This obviously doesn't work in an OTP environment, especially with time-based tokens. So we spent a lot of work on this so that, and as well as our login module to support being able to replicate that the user actually has a real authenticated session, even when they logged in with a one-time password, and share this information amongst the JBoss cluster. This module has since been contributed back to the community. You could download it if you want. And this really has allowed us to achieve 100% uptime in the last year for our identity provider. Federated logout? Anyone doing federated logout? Yeah. So it's bad. So the way the SAML spec was written, federated logout is this very bizarre thing where the IDP will try to log you out and redirect the user's browser to then log out of any service providers that they've authenticated to. Keeping track of this information is a challenge in itself as to what actual service provider the user needs to log out of is its own challenge. But then the way the SAML spec was written, it requires the user to sequentially, it essentially directs the user's browser to try to sequentially log the user out of every SP. So if the user SP has any kind of issues, can't reach to it, your logout, your entire logout process fails. This doesn't work well when you have more than one service provider. So there's a really nice write-up on the Shibboleth page that's listed there on why there's all these log issues with federated logout. We're working, but you know we have this requirement that we need to provide federated logout. So all right, well the way we're working on doing this is basically trying to write our own application that will perform AJAX backend logouts on behalf of the user concurrently, without having to rely on user redirects and iterating through all the service providers. That way, if one fails, the entire chain isn't broken. This is kind of a hard problem to solve, but we're working on it. So, service providers. I sigh because if you've ever dealt with a service provider integration, you will know how much of a pain it is. Service providers will usually implement the SAML 2.0 spec, the required functionality, but some number of the optional standards. And this gets really interesting when those optional implementations conflict with each other. The service provider might require the SAML assertion to be signed this way, but our identity provider hasn't implemented that feature yet. So this provides creates a lot of headaches, and frankly, some service providers we just can't integrate with because the functionality isn't there on either side. So occasionally we receive a request where we have to say, not now, we'll work on implementing this and come back to us in 6 months. So if you're doing one of these integrations for the first time, give yourself weeks. And it takes a long time to go back and forth with the vendor. So on the open source library and module side of things, there's a variety of open source libraries, modules, that can be used to provide SAML service provider integrations. So if your application's written in JBoss or Java, you can use the picket link functionality there. We have a couple applications using this that works perfectly well. Shibboleth and OpenSAML have kind of the same thing, but they have similar functionality. It works fine. If your application is written in Python, there's PySAML. If you're dealing with a PHP application, things get interesting because there's simple SAML PHP, which if you've never used this and you run IDP, I'd recommend you actually install it. Not necessarily because you're going to use it for a service provider, but it's a great tool for debugging connections, debugging IDP issues. Part of our standard environment build, when we're bringing up a new IDP in a net new environment, we'll install a simple SAML PHP node just so we could test and make sure that SAML is working correctly from the IDP, configure things in certain ways, and even prove to service providers that know the problems on their end. And if you're running Drupal at all, simple SAML PHP is one of the two ways Drupal can do SAML service provider. It can be a SAML service provider, so that works really well. On Ruby, there's the Ruby SAML gem. And then things get really interesting on the Apache module side. There is modauth melon and modauth SAML. And these are drop-in modules for Apache to provide HTTP-level authentication from Apache so that your application doesn't need to even be aware of SAML at all. Just hand it off to Apache. I'll talk about modauth melon. It works very similar to modauth curb. If you've ever used modauth curb, it just drop it in and it works. It's now, I'm really excited about this, and that it's now included in RHEL 6.6. It's the first time Red Hat has distributed this, so it's there and makes life really easy to get started with this. When 6.6 was in beta and pre-beta, we decided to test modauth melon that's provided, and lo and behold, it didn't work with Picolink. Surprising that, you know, our two engineering groups might not talk to each other. I know it's a shocker, but it was that way. So we reached out to them, to the group adding it to RHEL, and patched it so that it would work with Picolink as well as some other IDPs, basically adding the assertion consumer service handling, if you're familiar with SAML. And then a really nifty way to provide SAML authentication for your application is to use a Apache reverse proxy. So you install modauth melon on a reverse proxy server, have it backed by an application that doesn't speak SAML, and just have your application trust the proxy nodes, and lo and behold, you have SAML working on the application where it's not supported. We just rolled this out with our Zimbra instance. Zimbra in its own right can do SAML authentication, I believe. But frankly, we didn't want to touch it. We had it working with GSS API authentication just fine, but we wanted to provide some level of webmail access that uses SAML. So this is the direction we went, where we installed a couple of Apache reverse proxy nodes and modauth melon. And this provides a really easy way in the future to integrate our internal applications without having to go bug the developers. Since modauth melon is somewhat new, and especially new to RHEL, the documentation's not that great on the Google code repo, I just walked through essentially the few steps you need to actually get it up and installed. You could download these files on the link I'll give you at the end. But you really just yum install it, you know, add your IDP metadata, set up your vhost, and restrict the location just like you would with modauth curb. And then you would just be able to hit your endpoint / metadata link to receive the service provider metadata. Then on the Apache proxy pass side, really easy, you can exclude, it's a little bit different from modauth curb in that if you want to turn SAML authentication off on the location, you actually have to set melon enabled to off. Then finally on your vhost, just, you know, set up your typical proxy pass. And, you know, we do SSL based connections from the proxy nodes back to the backend servers. So, and you could obviously exclude certain URLs from your proxy pass if you have a ping check that your load balancer needs for whatever reason. So that is how Red Hat does SAML. It's been one of the more exciting features that we've added lately, and we've spent the last really year and a half working on building out our and expanding our SAML infrastructure. We have around 20 different service providers at this point, both internal and external applications. So we found it to be very nice, especially we received a twofold increase in traffic when we introduced the GSS API integrations. So lo and behold, a lot of people actually started making use of it once they didn't have to pull out their phone or hardware token. So PKI, anyone doing full-fledged PKI? Yeah? Yeah, it's a pain. It's hard. So we are heading down this route with PKI. Red Hat, you know, we've grown to a point where we're an 8,000 person company. And a couple years ago, we, you know, realized that, hey, using OpenSSL doesn't really scale. It's kind of painful. So we went down the road of implementing Red Hat certificate system. And if you're not familiar with the Red Hat certificate system, it's a highly secure PKI solution. It's used in places I can't really talk about, but it's there and it's a completely supported a PKI solution. It meets all the FIPS government standards, and as well as supporting hardware key management devices. So I don't want to actually store my signing key locally on a server or a VM or whatever. Here's a appliance that's all it does is just manage my keys. And Red Hat certificate system uses directory server as a backend. So you get a lot of the highly available fault tolerance from directory server in certificate system. And after a couple years ago, we open sourced Red Hat certificate system, which actually came as part of the Netscape acquisition. We then turned around, open sourced it. It's now the dog tag certificate system. I think they're working on a 10.2 release that is actually really some really nice functionality. We're using the Red Hat stabilized version. Red Hat certificate system has a variety of components like most PKI solutions. The main part is the certificate authority. This actually is what processes and signs a certificate request. There's a token management system, so if you want to use smart card authentication, you could use this. We don't use it internally. There's also a data recovery manager, so if you want to do encryption, basically email encryption or encryption using X509 certificates, you could use that. We tend to use GPG encryption internally, so we don't use this component. There's a registration authority, and this is simply a front end to Red Hat to the certificate authority. So the RA just front ends the CA. And this is more flexible. You can modify it for whatever your needs are. If you want to use SEP, which is a simple enrollment protocol for networking devices to receive certificates, you could use the registration authority. And then finally, the OCSP responder. And this is what the OCSP responder is, what your browser actually talks to. If I go to gmail.com or whatever, and on the back end, your browser will contact the OCSP server to verify that certificate is still valid and should still be trusted. So certificate system has this functionality. We're using it internally. Our main use cases for the PKI, really, we wanted to replace our internal server encryption identification system. So I mentioned we were using OpenSSL to issue internal server certs and Puppet certs and everything else, right? And that doesn't scale, especially when you start getting into the, you know, thousands of nodes, right? Let alone tens of thousands. So that was the main use case. We also use TLS client authentication with certificates a lot. Our mobile devices all have a client certificate on them that uses that's how it authenticates to our Zimbra servers. We use it for TLS authentication to with a lot of our applications, cloud-based applications, where one application might need to talk to another application to exchange data. This connection is secured using certificates and TLS authentication. If you're a Red Hat customer and you've used the new subscription management stuff that's default in RHEL 7, this is using TLS authentication on the back end. And then finally, we wanted to use SEP for network devices. This hasn't turned out to work as we had hoped, and that a lot of our network devices don't support the stronger ciphers. Let's just say it, most network devices will support, you know, MD5, and you're lucky if they support SHA-1. So we have those turned off, but it's there. So the way we deployed certificate system, we wanted a multi-tier design that spans data centers, eliminate any single point of failure. We have redundant HSM devices for key storage. We've puppetized the deployment installation of certificate system, which if you've ever deployed it or touched it, it can be a real pain to set up. So we've tried to take the complexity out of that and allow for rapid provisioning. Our root and intermediate CAs are offline. It's kind of a PKI best practice. We use a SHA-512 message digest cipher. We do offer a self-service user certs for all users that they just authenticate with their one-time passwords. And hey, you could have a user cert that you need for whatever. And we allow sysadmin groups, Red Hat has a ton of sysadmin groups, to go and issue their own certificates for their servers they manage. If they have root on the box, they should probably be the ones who issue the cert for it. And we do have a custom plugin to support LDAP authentication or authorization to certificate system. We had to do this custom, but we'll... In the upstream version, it's been added back. So our cert chain looks something like this. Our InfoSec group, and only our InfoSec group, has access to our root CA that's offline someplace. I don't know where it is. I don't want to know, but it's offline someplace. That CA was basically spun up, used to sign the intermediate CA cert once, and then shut down. That the root CA has then since been imported into pretty much every user's laptop, browser, device, whatever. The root CA signed the intermediate CA, which is also kept offline, and which signed the R operational CA, which is it runs and is active with what users interface with on a daily basis. And that's what issues server certs and user certs. And then finally, those certs get installed on, or the keys get installed on the various servers. So our cluster architecture, this is what our certificate authority looks like. Basically, a fairly standard, highly available cluster, where there's two certificate authority nodes behind a couple redundant load balancers. They use LDAP on the back end to provide authorization via using one-time passwords. And for self-service, a lot of the attributes in self-service user certificate get fed out of our corporate LDAP instance. On the OCSP cluster side of things, which is a completely separate component, separate architecture, basically, our certificate authorities will publish the certs they've issued, what's still valid, to the OCSP cluster. These are load balance nodes with, essentially a F5 in front, balancing traffic between the various OCSP nodes. And, of course, underneath is using a Red Hat directory server to provide the bidirectional replication. Overview of our PKI environment. Basically, InfoSec signed the root CA that's been imported. The reason we have intermediate CA is for expandability. If other groups want to manage their own certificate authority, whether it's OpenSSL or certificate system or dog tag or whatever, they're welcome to do so, and we just sign those certs using the intermediate CA. And we'll also, when we get to IDM and IPA, that's what's used to sign those certificates. And so our PKI admins that we have designated have access to both the internal and operational or intermediate and operational CAs, and users would interact with the operational CAs. Users have their browsers configured to point to the various OCSP clusters, one for the internal or intermediate CA and one for the operational CA. So this is kind of similar to what you guys do, run PKI? No? Yeah. Yeah. For, you mean if a user wants to receive their own certificate for, I'm sorry, what? For a mobile device, mobile devices are a little bit different, but they essentially go to a web form, request it, and they get sent back to a link that's an escrow server, and then they authenticate to the escrow server, then they're sent a specialized link to import the PKCS12 file into their phone. It's kind of an elaborate process that we had to do, mostly for iPhone support. Yeah. Yeah.
And your root CA, is that one of the ones that is commonly trusted by browsers, or do you have to push it yourself?
We have to push it in ourselves. Red Hat, we don't want to use our position as an operating system company to distribute our internal CA globally. So, you know, we just stay out of that business, right? It's just the standard. CAs in Firefox that come as part of RHEL that you guys receive. And from an IT perspective, when we're provisioning a new user and hand them their laptop, that's part of the image is that our CA is installed there. If a user is self-managed, then they have to go and import the CA themselves. They don't get far without importing it, so it's a problem that usually solves itself. So I'll talk briefly about IDM and free IPA. Anyone using IDM or free IPA? Yeah? Nice. So this has been a long journey to develop free IPA, and the Red Hat stabilized version is called IDM. It's available in RHEL for free. You just need a base RHEL subscription and you could install it. And what it stands for is Red Hat Identity Management. They're essentially positioning it as a product that is AD for Linux, but let's be fair, you know, Active Directory is really Kerberos and LDAP for Windows. So this IDM, Free IPA, combines Kerberos, LDAP, and PKI into a single solution. As part of that, in the brand new version, you get one-time password support as well, but also bind NTP and native Active Directory integration, which can be really nice. It has a very nice set of GUI and command line tools that you use to interface with it. Basically, it loads Kerberos on top of LDAP, and it takes advantage of LDAP to provide the replication, the high availability, the redundancy that's required as part of this environment. Because it's based on everything that's on top of directory server, you could have up to 20 master servers that all replicate changes back and forth amongst the two. It also has an integrated PKI solution that's been developing rapidly in terms of features and functionality. From a replication agreement standpoint, you really have the main directory server instance and then a separate certificate system instance that have replication agreements with the various other master servers in the environment. So the way this works is Kerberos uses IDM or LDAP to provide its master functionality. This eliminates the single point of failure problem I spoke about earlier with Kerberos, and that, lo and behold, you now have a multi-master Kerberos system. No single point of failure, no master. It replaces Kprop, which can be known to be buggy and have limitations, especially over high latency connections. Kprop will usually time out and eat itself. It has an integrated bind solution, so it's a really easy way to provide DDNS if you want that in your environment. Basically, it's PKI without the pain. Implementing any PKI solution is painful. Red Hat certificate system, we got it up and running, but you know, not without some headaches. And it has a nice Windows 80 sync feature that can sync passwords back and forth with Active Directory. If you haven't checked it out or haven't heard of it, I would check it out. It's kind of a really nice project. Red Hat IT, we've been working with the IDM folks over the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years to really get IDM to a point where we can implement it internally. It's now to a point where we can implement it internally, so that's what we'll be spending the next year doing. So we're working on that, and that's definitely something that we want to do in the future. And so we just need to figure out how to actually switch to this. But it solves a lot of the problems that we have in our environment today, particularly around Kerberos. One thing that they're doing as part of IPA and IDM is there's a new Ypsilon project. And I'm not sure if I'm speaking out of turn here for SIMO, but this is from the Ypsilon page, webpage. But IDM is, this really provides the SAML functionality, is similar to what we have internally as part of IDM. So this is, it's going to be several years before it's usable. But you know, it's something to definitely check out and follow. I have no idea when this will actually be productized, but it's there. It works today. It provides a lot of the GSS API SAML integrations that we'd have a separate solution for today. And so it's being openly developed in the community. So check it out if you're interested. In closing, this is kind of how Red Hat does open source identity management. I haven't spoken about anything that I don't personally recommend. Being in Red Hat IT, we get exposed to a lot of the Red Hat products, a lot of the open source solutions. These are ones that I could really recommend. And that's, for me, I'm not on commission, so. these are ones that I can't speak highly enough of. And if you're a large-scale enterprise, definitely check out Red Hat Directory Server and EAP. If you're a small organization, really IDM, IPA, is something that you might want to check out. So, are there any questions, comments, tomatoes? Thank you.
So, is this on?
Yeah.
Are we okay? So I actually have a couple of questions, one of which is a little bit more in the weeds, but a broader thing, the architecture that you describe, you've got a lot of systems that user passwords are passing through. And has that actually been a concern for you?
Sure.
That's sort of question number one. Question number two is, did you look at using OTP as a Kerberos pre-auth mechanism?
So, to answer your second question first, yes, we have looked at using OTP as pre-auth. It's something that we're investigating very, very heavily right now. To date, we've always shied away from doing that because basically the user complaints, right? Our users would really hang us out to dry if we did that. But now with the environment the way it is, and the more we go to kind of SAML-based solutions, it's something that we're pursuing, and it's actually probably going to be one of our targets for next fiscal year. In terms of passing user passwords around, really, though, we try to avoid that wherever possible. Some applications are stupid. They just require a password, right? And if there's a strong enough business case for that application, we just kind of have to support it. It's not something we want to do, and we actively discourage it wherever possible.
Hey, so good presentation. Have you explored doing anything besides Radius? Radius is still exposed to SSTA brute force attacks. And so we have a lot of switching equipment, and Radius seems to have been what was implemented before I got there. And so now I'm looking at ripping it out there, kicking and screaming as fast as I can. But we haven't really found anything that's viable, that's well supported. LDAP's starting to come up, but it not by a lot of vendors nor old vendors. So I was curious if you'd done any research along those lines.
So we don't like using Radius any more than you do. But at this point, it's pretty much all we have. We've tried to isolate Radius to back-end networks that, you know, only very trusted systems can talk to, and front-end it with LDAP where necessary. I'd love to talk to you if you have better ideas around.
Can you speak a little bit about your plans for implementing IDM, and if you plan to replace any of your existing directory server certificate services components, and you know, what do you think the issues might be? Be implementing that?
Yeah, so, you know, we are definitely looking at implementing IDM. On the directory server side, we'll probably maintain some level of LDAP slaves, particularly for mail routing and some application usage. IDM can do replicate, obviously, IDM can replicate some data back and forth with directory server. So that's probably a direction we'll head down as well. This is something that, you know, we're really just talking about for next fiscal year, so we don't have a lot of the details worked out, other than to say that, you know, that's kind of the general direction we're going.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Hi.
We're seeing a lot of software, both internally and externally, that want to use OpenID, and we haven't yet, but we've looked at trying to do OpenID through SAML. I was just wondering if you had seen that as well or tried it.
So I'm definitely aware of OpenID. We haven't had any use cases for it yet. One thing that we are starting to see is some OAuth request, and Picketlink can provide that kind of SAML and OAuth integration. OAuth is more about authorization than authentication, versus SAML, you kind of get both. So we do have some applications that want OAuth tokens, and we are heavily looking into that route. Not so much on the OpenID route.
Hi, have you got any thoughts on implementation in either IDM or some of your other tools for self-service group membership?
Yes. So we do some of that. We have some web interfaces that have privileges, ACIs defined in a directory server, where certain people can modify their group memberships within reason, basically a combination of an application, front-end application, and LDAP ACIs on the back end to restrict who could add what where. But we do some of that, not nearly as much as we should. For the most part, when just a regular user wants to change groups, it's a ticket.
Question about SCAP. You kind of skipped through it. I guess you're not using it that much. What's the alternative?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
SCAP?
Oh, yeah.
What's the alternative for not using SCAP?
Copy and paste. that's.
I mean, have you... we tried to implement SCAP to authenticate mobile clients and get them to generate certificates for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you've thought about that, or if there is something else other than SCAP that you can.
Yeah, there's definitely use cases for it, particularly on the user side. I want to cert. We don't use that today. Really, the main use case we had for SCEP setup was for networking devices to be able to fetch their own certs. Basically, have a pin that then the router or firewall will go and fetch a signed certificate from certificate system. As I mentioned, the device support isn't there for a lot of the network, especially the big name network hardware. I'm not sure about Cisco, but I definitely know Juniper cannot support anything greater than SHA-1. And I think Cisco's the same way, although I'm not sure. Does that help? Yeah.
Okay. What are your NIS users doing?
That's a great question. Basically, there's a lot of them. The people have been with the company for 10 plus years. A lot of people on the engineering side that just love NIS for whatever reason. Whether it's the ability to have local map caches, although they could have that with SSSD now. So I'm not really sure. I just know that we get yelled at if we turn it off. And we've tried to work with the groups to get them to move to LDAP. We don't support NIS authentication, right? It's just strictly user information and group information. So it's not a security risk, but at the same time, it's not something we really want to support. Yeah, I feel you, man.
Anybody else have any other questions? Well, I think this was a really, really great presentation. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.